Tonight on Arena, we welcome the return of Axel Foley in Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, and violinist Zoe Conway plays live in studio. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena because you'd be able to see Zoe Conway playing besides lots of other things. The RTE Concert Orchestra with conductor David Brophy will be joined by folk musician and associate artist Zoe Conway, John McIntyre, Julie Fowlis and Eamon Dourley. These musicians, who are also great friends, will come together to celebrate the shared heritage where Ireland and Scotland meet, blending traditional and folk styles with classical music. The two couples will perform live in two concerts, one on August the 9th at the National Concert Hall and on August the 10th in Wexford as part of the Fla Ciol na hÉireann. The concert titled Éire is Alba delves into the cultural connections between Ireland and Scotland. I'm delighted, as I said, to be joined in studio by Zoe Conway and on the line from Scotland by Julie Fowlis. So Zoe, you're so welcome, and you're going to play live, but we're going to have a chat first between about this connection made real by your relationship with Julie between Ireland and Scotland. So it came about when you were involved in Port, a T.G. Cahir and BBC Alba series.
That's right. And Julie was actually presenting on the show at the time. And so we got to play a few tunes together and work on different songs. And we just hit it off really as part of that series. And Julie thought it would be nice for us to maybe work on a few projects ourselves coming forward. So we were kind of throwing ideas over and back, and we thought it would be nice to maybe take some Irish language poetry and Scots Gaelic poetry and make songs out of them, or, you know, put music to them, I suppose. So that's really where it all came about.
Yes, Julie, because you've had a Scots Gaelic always in your life. You're fluent in it, you write in it, you're committed to it.
I am, of course. And I suppose one of the things that we chatted about, Zoe and I, was the fact that there's this amazing scene of music that we have in the traditional sector, both in Scotland and in Ireland. But I suppose one of the things that maybe we don't hear as much of is songwriting in both the Gaelic and the Irish language. And it was something that we wanted to kind of put a bit of thought into and spend a bit of time working on together. And we really enjoyed working on an album together, primarily of songs, and since then we've just kind of continued the journey, and now we're already working on a second album.
And how did those conversations go, Julie, when you or Zoe and you decided that you'd look at old poetry?
Well, I think at the beginning, I think we did look, we looked back. I think that's always in our nature as traditional musicians. We're always aware of what's gone before, and we're always drawing from that well of tradition. It's constantly inspiring and energizes us, you know, but it's really important to look forward to and to contemporary writers. So we dipped into the tradition, looked back at some very, very old poetry, much of which was unknown and had, you know, we don't know who the composers mm-hmm. were, but we also looked at contemporary writers, and it was brilliant to have that kind of breadth of writing, kind of going back several hundred years, and some that had only been composed in the last 5 years.
Now, Zoe, we're going to play one of those tracks from the album that you and Julie did with John, your husband, and Eamon, Julie's husband. It's called A Fuisha a Yodasa. Will you just talk us into the track?
Yeah, so, I mean, part of what we were looking for in the poetry was, I suppose, a metre and a mood that might suit being set to music. So this one jumped out at me in particular. It's a Martin O'Gearan poem, and he's from the Aran Islands in the west of Ireland, and he talks in the poem about getting back to his own people in the west, and walking along the beach morning and evening, and that's where he'll find his peace. So Fuisha a Yodasa means I will find solace.
Shay
That's Fuita Fayudsa there, performed by Zoe Conway and sung there by Julie Fowlis with Eamon Dourley and John McIntyre. So you got the men into the room with you. Zoe, how did that all work? Julie, tell us your own partner, Eamon. What does he play and what was he bringing to the mix?
Well, he plays bouzouki and he plays fiddle as well. And we even got him on singing a little bit too. And I think that was one of the things, you know, before we started the project, we kind of, I certainly had an idea of what it might sound like. And because I love Zoe and John's playing so much, I know their music well. And of course, having played with Eamon for so long, I kind of had an idea of what the unit, like the group, might sound like. But one of the things that really took my breath away at times was the joy of singing all together and the way that the voices stack together and have different textures. And it was a real, real joy as a singer to work on those harmonies and find space in around one another's voices. And that was one of the most beautiful things of working together in the first album, and something that we've, I guess, has maybe developed over our time of playing together. But essentially, yes, there's this guitar and bouzouki sound, sometimes piano as well, and the fiddle, of course, and yeah, the arrangement of voices around the two languages.
And Zoe, what do you recall from those sessions? Where were they done? Did you have kind of busking sessions where you were working everything out before you recorded it, or how did it work?
Yeah, well, we kind of do a lot of work remotely, which I find quite remarkable. Obviously, we're living in Ireland and they're living in Scotland. So a lot of it is over and back on the emails and putting up ideas and sharing photos of poems and things like that. And then when we get together, we kind of work furiously pulling everything together and working on ideas and arrangements. So the original recording, the first album, we recorded in Inverness with Julian Eamon, and the one that we're working on now, Julian Eamon came to Ireland and we recorded in Black Mountain Studios in County Louth, quite near where I'm living.
And this is the one where you work with Donal Lunny.
Exactly. So for this one, just in a kind of a development, we invited Donal Lunny to come along and kind of, I suppose, help us listen as we recorded, because a lot of it we record together as four people at one time, which is part of the beauty of it, as opposed to everyone being in a separate area recording at a separate time. So Donal was able to kind of listen as we performed and said, OK, take three was it, you know, now we can move on, or maybe you should do this or the other. So he really took a kind of producer role on it, and in fact we managed to invite him to come and play on a few things as well. So
so was that quite a different experience, the experience in Ireland, to the one in Inverness, Julie?
In a way it was, but in some ways not so much. It was very, the way that we like to approach recording is, as Zoe said, kind of live and in the moment. So you're kind of trying to capture that energy that you that we're always kind of striving to create. So in that sense, it was a similar approach, but it was great having having Donal present and feeding his own special energy into this project. It was a real treat to have him around.
Now, I'm sure you won't mind, Julie, seeing as I have Zoe live here, we're going to ask her to do a bit of work. She's going to perform. Yeah, and she's got two fiddles, so I think that might mean she's going to do two different pieces. So this one is a Barna Maeve, or Maeve's Gap. Do you want to tell us anything about it, Zoe, or just play away?
Oh, well, this one is one that I composed, and it's inspired by the Cooley Mountains. And it talks about the story from Anton Beau Coulne, where Queen Maeve's army comes up over the mountain, and there were so many of them that they left a track in the mountain. And that's to this day called Maeve's Gap, or Barna Maeve. And this is one of the ones that we will be performing with orchestra in August.
Lovely. All ready here, so off you go, Zoe.
Thank you.
wonderful. That's the marvellous Zoe Conway playing Maeve's Gap, or Barna Maeve. Julie, just to leave Alba and Aoire aside for a moment, the young people of Ireland will not be happy if I don't ask you about you being the musical voice of a Disney princess in Brave. How did that come about?
Oh gosh, it's a little while ago now. I was expecting my second child at the time, and I was invited to come along and provide vocals for the amazing Disney Pixar Princess Merida. And Princess Merida was, of course, she's the heroine in the film Brave, which was set in Scotland. And it really was a joy to be part of that whole experience and to work with the creative team. They were a hugely inspiring bunch, and myself and Eamon worked closely with them on the two songs in the film. And she remains a good friend to us to this day yet, Merida.
I'm sure.
I guess if I've got to be associated with one Disney princess, I'm pretty happy that it's her. She's pretty
feisty. So cool. She's fabulous. Red hair, hasn't she? And
that's right.
She's so brave. Yeah,
she is. Now,
Aoire is Elba, Zoe. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for you, that coming together of the two cultures?
Well, personally, I have always been inspired by the music of Donegal and Scotland, and always been drawn to the music from Northern Ireland and from the North. And it's just something that I think is in my blood. And ever since I was little, they're the tunes I've been collecting. So I would go around as a child with copybooks, and I would just write the start of those tunes, you know, that would jump out to me. And it turns out time and time again that there are Scottish tunes that have come through there, you know. So there's always that very strong link. And when I began to play with Julie and Eamon, it really just knitted together so seamlessly, you know, that it just feels like a very natural progression for me as an artist.
And Julie, for you, what's the link for you?
I think, just thinking on the track that you played at the beginning there, Fuishiva Ayotsa, I think that exemplifies for me the links, because when Zoe played me that, played me her idea for the song and the melody, and I saw the words, and we thought, well, let's do a Gaelic version, let's translate it. But in fact, it almost needs no translation, because the words are almost, you know, one for one the same in Scottish Gaelic and in Irish. So there are times where the language feels very, very close. There are times too, of course, where they feel further away, like strong dialects or cousin languages. But there are these special moments where almost no translation is needed, and you feel like it's all in the one. And we have the same route going back so long, and it feels very, very special.
Now we're going to end this evening with a waltz and a reel. The waltz is the Half Moon and the reel is the Hangman's, and Zoe is ready with her new fiddle. Thank you. wonderful. Never was a hangman's reel so joyful. Zoe Conway, thank you so much. And Julie Fowles, thank you. Era is Alba will be on in the National Concert Hall on the 9th of August, and they will be off to Wexford then for Flaghuil na hÉireann on the following day, the 10th of August. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and it's quite a County Louth love-in this evening. Zoe Conway's from Louth, my producer Nasa is from Louth, and my next guest, Austin Duffy, is from Louth. And Austin is a writer. His previous novels were The Living and Immortal Things, 10 Days and The Night Interns, which explored themes relating to his day job as a consultant oncologist. But in his new book, Cross, he grasped the nettle of the Troubles and explores rising tensions in a Republican border stronghold on the eve of the first IRA ceasefire in 1994. And Austin joins me now in studio, another Louth representative. You're so welcome. So the dark days of the Trouble is a subject a lot of people fear to go near, but you've dived in there, leaving the wards and the doctors and nurses behind you, and exploring these days in the dying ends of the Troubles, when the ceasefire and then leading into the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. I was kind of interested in that area for a couple of reasons. I mean, I grew up in Dundalk, so around the border area, and sort of came of age in through the 1980s, you know, when you're listening to the news and every night the local, we used to get the Northern News, and every single evening there'd be the local Northern News come on and telling of some person being killed or some act, whether it was a person delivering something or just an off-duty police officer or whatever, someone who was caught up in the Troubles in one capacity or another. And it was just a constant, you know, of that time period, to the extent that you didn't think it would ever end. So then when 1994 comes along, I'm a bit older then at that age, and I just thought that whole period of time was fascinating. But in retrospect, because to be honest, you know, at that particular time, I wasn't probably keeping up with it as much as I would have been. But I was, you know, in my 20s at that stage. And it was only really when I was living in America, when I started working on this book. In fact, I came across a notebook where the first line of the book is actually written, and that was dated from 2012, the same year my son was born, actually. So the book now, which has come out, is the same age as him. And I guess it was an excuse for me to go back and look into that whole area. I did a lot of reading about it. I found the whole history of it fascinating, the way that politics basically eventually got us out of the mess and the darkness. And although that in itself was this messy and difficult problem.
Because it is dark, as the narrator says in Cross, that Northern Ireland was apartheid to its bones. And then what kind of a picture do you paint of Cross, this border village?
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. So it's a fictional town, but very recognisable, I think, in sort of as a place that is full of people, archetypes in many ways, characters that we would all recognise from our past, or hopefully the past, but people who are under the sway of a particular ideology. And that, I guess, for me, is one of the main messages of the book, that, you know, it almost doesn't really matter what the ideology is. You know, but if you're part of a community that is sort of under the sway of this ideology, that it is going to lead you away from behaviours that are more centred towards people, and to lead you down a path where bad things happen, where disasters can happen, where tragedies can happen. And obviously here, yeah, the topic was republicanism and armed republicanism, but I could have picked any, you know, I'd like to think the book is universal in that I could have picked any community It could have been a loyalist community. It could have been a religious community. It could have been a non-religious, secular. It could have been a commune. It could have been left, right, whatever. Mm-hmm. It does. History has sort of taught us, hasn't it, that it doesn't really matter what direction the ideology lies in. But if that's your priority over the people in front of you, well, you're going to be led astray.
So we're deep within the Republican movement here in Cross, and Francie, the IRA officer commanding South Down. And we see Francie's philosophy. He's a committed Marxist. He's kind of a Knoll-style IRA gunman and strategist. And now he is trying to manage a kind of younger brigade of people involved in murder and killing. Like the tout again is the most feared, not the most feared person, but the person most looked out for and has to be got rid of.
Right, exactly. And just the character of Francie, I thought it was interesting because, you know, ostensibly he's kind of, or initially when you're reading the book first, you might think of him as being in some ways a hero or certainly a sympathetic character. But as you rightly say, he is dyed in the wool. He's an extremist, essentially. And he is the representative of a type of character who is very much against moving forward with peace process and the political movement. He really hearkened back to sort of an idealistic way of looking at the world, definitely in his case influenced by Marxism and, you know, extreme left ideology, but had a sort of a very idealistic view of how he wanted the world to be. And obviously that didn't match up with reality. And he was prepared to do something about that in terms of taking up arms or leading other people to do that and to commit murder or abetting murder. And then on the other hand, the other main character in the book is a politician called MOC. And similarly, you know, when you on first reading of the book, you would think, well, he's the villain. You know, he's the crafty politician that you wouldn't trust as far as you could throw him, you know. But then again, he is the person that leads us out of the mess, you know, and through political means and away from sort of terrorism and violence.
There are some frightening people in this. I mentioned the younger operatives that Francie is trying to keep control of. Handy, for example, mm-hmm. is like the worst, because you could imagine him. He's a great shot. He's cold hearted, and yet he has no moral core whatsoever. Not Marxism. Not Republican. Even.
Right. Yeah, he's a loose cannon, you know, and he can do what he wants. He's got a certain credibility within the community because of his family background, also because of the acts that he's committed. So there's no hindering force on Handy. He's basically a law unto himself. So such as there is a law at all that he has to pay attention to. And I guess what I'm trying to get at there is that if you do go down that road, even if you start off with the best intentions and have the greatest justification, you know, it leads you to places ultimately and leads you to characters behaving in a certain way that is really not in any way conducive to a functioning or healthy society. And again, that can happen. Here we're talking about republicanism, but, you know, it's not really just a pick on republicanism. You could pick any ideology under the sun and it would lead you to the exact same place or even worse.
Is the, you talked about MOC there being this politician, but, you know, a very unlikely saviour. So but at the same time, he got in, they were the type of people that got the peace process over the line. Is the novel in the end pessimistic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm afraid it is a little bit. I think it's a mixed message, just like the character of MOC. Yeah, he's a complicated individual. And it's people like him. They're not black and white characters. You know, they're not wholly good, but probably not wholly bad either, because life is messy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And characters like human beings are much more interesting than those kind of two-dimensional cutouts. But yeah, I mean, he's not exactly exactly someone that you'd who's very trustworthy, and yet he leads the story forward. But yes, there is a little bit of pessimism, because without giving away the ending, the story does lead you to suggest that a lot of these characters, you know, are able to persist and hang around. And there's still a certain level of criminality that can sort of persist.
Yes.
And of course, because you know, you don't click your fingers and people suddenly change overnight after being living under certain conditions for years and years and years. And they're the victims in this too. And I hope to get that across as well. It's not their fault. They weren't born bad. It's more that the prevailing winds pushed them in a certain direction.
Well, the novel is called Cross, and it's published by Granta. Austin Duffy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's time for our Wednesday night TV reviews. It's been 30 years since Detroit's most famous cop, Axel Foley, solved a crime in the Californian sunshine in 94. But today, Netflix have launched Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, with Eddie Murphy making a comeback as the anarchic detective in one of the biggest movie franchises of the 80s and 90s. BBC4 bring us End of Summer, a new Scandinavian thriller series about a five-year-old boy who vanishes in rural Sweden in the 80s and is never found. 20 years later, his sister Vera meets a young man in a therapy session who describes his memory of a boy the wind missing, which sounds very familiar and disturbing. So she investigates. And finally, BBC Two bring us The Turkish Detective, an eight-part series adapted from the best-selling Inspector Ickman novels by Barbara Nadel. Set in Istanbul, the series follows the adventures of Ickman and his partners as he solves crimes in the frenzied world of modern day Turkey. I'm joined by Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke, who have been doing lots of viewing. Declan, about 30 years now since we have seen the last Beverly Hills Cop. Have you been waiting for another reboot all that time? Were you on tenterhooks?
Not quite on tenterhooks, Kay. And yeah, no, it's a very good question. Do we really need another Axel Foley movie? The short answer is probably no, but having watched it, I'm glad they gave it to us. Look, so, you know, it and story-wise, and we're not going to give away too much about the plot, but the listeners will know that it starts in Detroit, where, you know, Axel gets into trouble, and as a result, he takes a jaunt out to LA and Beverly Hills. In this one, Eddie Murphy plays Axel Foley reconnecting with his estranged daughter, who's played by Taylor Page, and he's investigating a corrupt cop who's played by Kevin Bacon, all of which is virtually irrelevant in comparison to we're there to see Eddie Murphy play the brash, that kind of character
and the music.
The music is terrific too. And what I liked about the music aspect was the kind of classic hits that they used back in the 80s and the 90s. They've kind of repurposed them. So it's in a way, it's like Axel Foley is doing a greatest hits tour of Beverly Hills, kind of reprising many of the plot points from previous movies. And also the music is kind of like a greatest hits, bringing us
and
back to the 80s.
The jackets, the shoes, and may I say the face of the 1990s.
He looks terrific. God terrific. Bless him. I need to talk to his consultants, mm-hmm. Can I put it that way.
So let's listen to a clip before we get Arlene's take on this. So Axel Foley, played by Eddie Murphy, goes to a hockey game with Detective Mikey Woody, and played by Kyle S. Moore, and he takes offence when Mike was surprised that Axel likes hockey.
Hey, Axel, I don't want to come off like some kiss ass, you know what I mean? But I did want to say, you're kind of the reason I got into police work in the first place.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that's very flattering.
Yeah, no, I mean, so when you reached out for the tickets, I gotta say, yeah, I was pretty pumped, you know? Told my wife, is Axel Foley, you know? And then come down here, pick your brain, you know. Honestly, I assume you didn't even like hockey, so this is...
Wait, why would you assume that I didn't like hockey? How could you just assume that?
Oh, because...
Because of custody.
No, don't do that. I did not assume...
Well, you made an assumption based on this that I did not like hockey.
No, it's just that you never talk about hockey, man.
Well, hockey happens to be in my blood.
It is?
My great-grandfather was actually a hockey player in the Negro Leagues in Winnipeg. The Winnipeg Black Guys.
Wait a second. There was a Negro... I mean... There was an all-black person hockey league?
Wait, so you're going to tell me that you're supposed to be a hockey fan, but you didn't realize there used to be a Negro League in hockey?
Shit. Axel, I am so sorry. I feel awful. Look, I can do better. I will do better. You're fucking with me!
I can do better. I will be better. I will be better. I don't have to stay this way. I can be a better white man.
That's me? Oh, yeah, but if I do you, then I am.
It's wildly offensive.
Yeah, it's a pretty funny joke, isn't it, Arlene?
He reeled him in. He threw out the line and he reeled him in. And he does this all the way through the movie. He still has that kind of wisecracking, sharp when he's thinking on his feet. You know, that's the whole thing about Axel Foley as well. Axel Foley, you know, when the chips are down, he can think on his own feet and he's sharp and he's smart. And he's always underestimated. In the earlier films, he was always underestimated and he was completely on the outs, you know, especially in Beverly Hills, where Beverly Hills is wealthy, so, so wealthy. I mean, you're not talking about normal wealth, wealth in the stratosphere. But here he's much more comfortable. He's grown up. He's a man now. He's much more comfortable in his own skin. And you can actually see that in the film. He's really, really comfortable in his own skin. He's able to make jokes like that because, you know, he knows who he is. But it's interesting then when he comes up against his daughter.
Yes, because the main reason he's gone to LA is his daughter, he finds out, is in trouble or could be in trouble.
Yeah, but she could very well be in trouble. And also his old friend, Rosewood, goes missing. Rosewood was in all three of the previous movies as well, played by Judge Reinhold. So he goes missing and he is working for Eddie's daughter in this. He's working for Jane. He's left the police force. He's working as a private detective. He's working for Jane in this complicated case at the start involving police corruption and a dead police officer.
Yeah, and Kevin Bacon is in a flash suit and
looking very, very Machiavellian. So, you know, so he goes there for two reasons. One is to reconnect with his daughter and the other is to find, you know, to find his old colleague. And initially, you know, the force are like, hey, welcome back. But then it sort of becomes like, hey, why are you trying to help this guy? This guy, you know, killed a cop.
And what's that relationship like between him and his daughter?
Not great. When the film starts, they are estranged. They haven't spoken for many years, actually, even though his friends are kind of trying to push him to get back in touch and so forth. She feels betrayed. She feels that he has been not a good father. Arlene said, you know, he's become a man in this film, but not soon enough for his daughter, Jane. And that's where there's a lot of kind of back and forth about, you know, father-daughter relationship. To me, that was the kind of lacuna in the film. They tried to bring serious drama into a kind of serious drama into a film that I don't think was strong enough to bear the.
And was there enough fun to make you enjoy it, or even if that was a little weak?
I thought all around terrific. There's great cameos. All the kind of old cameo star are back. Not sure it'll send anyone who has never seen the Beverly Hills Cop movies back to watch the original trio. I think that's wrong. If you have seen them and enjoy them, I think you'll enjoy this very much.
I would never have thought that you were a Beverly Hills Cop.
I am a child of the 80s. Okay, what can I tell you?
So stars out of five for you, Declan.
I give it a strong three stars.
Three for you and for you, Arlene.
I gave it 3 out of 5 as well. I think it's perfect for a wise, cracking, action-driven romp. And it was nice to see Eddie back on the screen.
All right. For Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F, 3 out of 5 from our two reviewers. Now, the end of summer, we leave the sunshine of California and head to Sweden for the new thriller on BBC Four. Vera, played by Julia Ragnarsson, is a psychologist whose younger brother, Billy, went missing 20 years earlier. And he's lost, devastated her family. Then, during a therapy session, a young man recounts a story of a missing boy, which makes Vera wonder if it could be about her brother. So, Arlene, this is it's complicated but a very enthralling scenario because we have flashbacks to the disappearance of the boy.
It's definitely complicated. The story is told in the now as Vera is a psychologist, and it's told in flashbacks as to the day when Billy went missing, and it's maybe a slight lead up to that as well. Vera herself is complicated because she's a very unreliable narrator. You know, she doesn't do things by the book. And actually, when we meet her first, when she's in her sessions, she's a grief counsellor and she's in her sessions, we discover very quickly that she's actually on suspension and she's there with a supervisor in the background taking notes and observing her because she's lost her licence or her license has been suspended because she got involved in a love affair with a client, which is, as you can imagine, is a complete no-no and breaks all boundaries when it comes to, you know, any kind of psychiatry or any sort of doctor-patient relationship. So from the off, you're, even though Vera sees things and hears things and has flashbacks and memories, you don't necessarily trust them.
Yes, because you know she's unreliable
because she
lives this chaotic life.
It's chaotic, and she physically harms herself. You know, it's not just a mental issue. She physically harms herself. She burns her hand. She puts her hands in the ice then to recover from it. And you know, there's a lot going on here. It's not just about the disappearance of her baby brother, even though that is a huge catalyst in her makeup and her psyche. But she had a very, very fractious relationship with her mother. There's all sorts of complicated issues there. She was also the last person to see Billy on the day in which he went missing. So the guilt of that, she carries that with her as well. So as she's coming into finding out, this guy, Isaac, arrives in and he discusses things that he could only really know if he'd been at their farmhouse or around their farmhouse or had been a friend. Or he could be a journalist trying to delve in and find out information, because the anniversary of Billy's disappearance is coming up and Billy's body has never been found.
Yes. And Declan, because it's been 20 years, she's been through all this before. Journalists sniffing around the story, trying to find backstories that would inform them or even be salacious about what happened. And it all gets very close and within the family about what could have gone wrong to lead to Billy's disappearance. Arlene talked about the mother-daughter relationship, but there were other issues in the wider family.
There are, and actually the whole series opens with the young Vera seeing her mother take her own life. So straight away, this is a very complex scenario. Her father, as you say, is 2 decades on now. Her father has never really come to terms with either the loss of his wife or the disappearance of his son. And because the young child's body was never found, or the child was never found, there is, of course, that sense of not knowing what happened, which is perhaps even a worse torture. And her older brother then, Matthias, who was kind of not quite a bully of an older brother when she was a child, he has grown up to become a policeman. But he wants Vera, who has never really given up on the idea of finding Billy, he wants her to stop all this nonsense because it's upsetting her father. He's turning 60 now. He's coming up to a big birthday, which kind of coincides with the suicide of his wife. So it's a very complex emotion. There's a lot of layers here. There's a lot to be plumbed. And all the characters, I mean, Vera is the main character. She's in virtually every scene. But the kind of intensity of the family dynamic really makes this feel quite claustrophobic.
And so much hangs on Vera, played by Julia Reganarsson. And it's a fantastic performance. Did you think, Arlene?
Yeah, I thought she was great. I thought it was little small movements that she did that I thought were fantastic. I just really like the way she carries herself. She carries herself as someone who's fragile, but as also someone who will, when she decides to do something, she will decide to do it. Like when she tries to, I'm not giving too much away because it's the first episode, you know, when this man comes into her clinic. You know, a normal person would say, listen, I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you. But, you know, when he doesn't turn up for the next session, she immediately decides, OK, I'm going to put my big girl pants on and I'm going to find this guy and discover what it is this guy wants about me and my family and who I am. And I'll get to the bottom of it herself. So she's kind of tough, but also flaky.
Yeah, she's unprofessional, but a fascinating watch.
Yes.
Yeah. So for you, Declan, stars out of 5.
A very strong 4 stars for me. This is fascinating, gripping. It's not just a family dynamic, but it's also kind of speaks, I think, about notions of identity and who we really are behind the mask and so forth. I think there's quite a bit about modern Sweden being talked about in this series.
From you, Arlene.
Oh, I give it a resounding 4 out of 5 as well. I really enjoy this. I like the layering in it a lot. And I think people are going to binge watch this. I think it's one of those shows that once you start watching it, you're going to get suckered right in.
We should say it's in subtitles and it's on BBC Four, but well worth a watch. And now we have yet another detective series. Mm-hmm. And for this one, we move to Istanbul for The Turkish Detective on BBC Two. And unlike End of Summer, which is in Swedish with subtitles, as I said, this series is in English and based on a series of best-selling novels about Inspector Ickman by Barbara Nadell. So, Arlene, It's not Inspector Erkman who we meet first, but this Mehmet Soleimani, who is a new colleague who comes to town.
Mehmet is a transplant from the Met in the Metropolitan Police in London, and he's asked for the transfer to come back over. Now, he was born in Istanbul and he grew up initially for his founding years in Istanbul before he moved with his mother to London. But he's come back and he's picked up at the airport by Detective Erkman, who he doesn't actually believe is a detective when he picks him up first, because he opens this disgusting car and he's a crumpled koala bear of a man. You know, he's like a Turkish version of Columbo. You know, he's just this rumpled, crumpled, chain-smoking, avuncular mess of a man. You know, but their styles are completely different. So from the outset, they kind of clash a little bit, because he says, please get in the car. And he opens the car door and the passenger seat is disgusting. And then he drives like a maniac all through Istanbul and, you know, brings him to the police station. And he hasn't even had a chance to unpack when he's right knee deep in a murder investigation. So he's this way. He operates this particular way. And Erkman and his team operate this particular way. And they're set up for this amazing clash of personalities.
Now, we'll find out that Mehmet Soleimani, played by Ethan Kaye, who's the guy who's come from the Met in London, has a past life himself, which he hints at when he's taken home by Erkman to meet the family. And he starts to explain to Erkman's family while he's in Istanbul.
Yeah, my mum and I left when I was young, but it's weird, even though I grew up in England, I never quite felt like home.
Perhaps that's why you became a detective. You have an objective eye.
Anyway, a few years ago, mum died, and yeah, I started to feel a pull.
What about your dad? Is he still alive?
Yeah, he is. He lives here.
Oh.
He must be excited to see you back home.
Our relationship's complicated.
Well, Fatoshchum, obviously there's more to the story than our friend is letting us know.
I agree. It's about a girl, I bet.
It's always about a girl.
Yes, Cherchez la femme, which we do later. Now, that sets it up with the two men having a chat there. But it's more than about these two cops playing off each other, isn't it, Declan? There's strong female roles and a strong female message through the Turkish detective.
This is what kind of elevated this series for me, Kay. I think you're absolutely right. So it sounds strange. You're talking about two male leads who aren't in the conversation there, but there are actually three leads. And the third is Detective Ayşe Fırsakoglu.
I'm glad you tried that one.
If I pronounce it wrong. Played by Yasmin K. Allen. And she doesn't have an awful lot to do in the first episode, but as the series progresses, then she comes more and more to the fore. And of course, the novels are written by Barbara Nadell, as you mentioned. It was 25, I think, in its entirety. And the murder victim, Gojda Seren, she's not just this conventional, quote-unquote, murdered young woman just to get the plot up and moving, because as the investigation proceeds, we find that, you know, she was on the surface a conventionally modern Turkish woman, but that she was secretly far more independent than her father and a fiancé might have preferred, and was actually secretly planning to escape the clutches of her fiancé. And again, not to give away too much about the plot, but you know, issues of contemporary feminism in Turkey come to the fore. An incel agitator, if I can use that phrase, becomes part of the story. And also part of the story is the Cherchez la femme, as you suggest, about Mehmet's old flame, who's called Leyla, played by Dylan Gwynn. She's a journalist who's based in Istanbul now and seems to be on the trail of sex traffickers and who has been brutally attacked as a result of that. All told, it seems to be, subtext is all about the patriarchy as it pertains in modern Turkey. Istanbul is very different to the rest of Turkey, but even in Istanbul, there seems to be a patriarchal flavour to everything that's going on, and the series seems to be peeling back the layers of that. Very, very interesting.
So how did that buddy element work with those bigger feminist issues that Declan's talking about that are explored?
It works because it relates to Istanbul as well. So Istanbul is a population of 15.5 million people, and you've got ultra-modern combined with complete traditional. You've got extreme wealth
combined with, you know, extreme poverty. So you've got like the buddy film, and then you've got this patriarchal system that they're running, that they have to kind of find a way to navigate this. And, you know, their job is murder, and murder is huge. And they have to bring everything back down to the very, very, you know, the bare bones of everything to find out what the heck is really going on with this girl, and what happened to her. Why was she killed? Why was she killed in such a bloody fashion? So actually, I think it works really well in Istanbul, because the city is so vast that when you pull it back down to this, as you said, like this buddy thing, but actually it's about the whole team and how they work together. So it actually works really well, because it takes the vastness and it condenses it down to this tiny little thing about this tiny little one murder, and it brings everything together.
And then the Soleimani, the Met cop who comes over, yeah, policeman who comes over to Istanbul, how does he develop?
Well, he has to learn how to navigate the systems in Istanbul, because he comes over with his London energy, let's say. I think that's fair to say. He comes over with his London energy. He's a bit like, you'll
yes,
do
if
what
he
I
sees,
say.
And if he sees drugs on the table, he just wants to go in and kicking and
so
punching.
So he has to learn. Ickman has a completely different methodology, and he talks to people as though they're human, and, you know, he might wander off and have a cigarette while he's in the middle of an interview with somebody, and no one really seems to know what he's observing and what he isn't observing, because that's how he carries himself. Like I said, he's like a little sort of koala Columbo of a man. You don't know what he's seeing and what he isn't seeing, but he'll come back really sharply to it a few minutes later, and you realise he's actually spotted something that you haven't spotted.
Okay, for the Turkish detective, Arlene, stars out of five.
I gave it 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it, but I think this is not a real criticism, but I think it actually moves a little bit too fast for the series. I would have liked it just to slow down a fraction. But again, it's a massive binge watch.
Okay, for you, Declan?
I would agree. 4 stars for me. The Inspector Ickman's terrific character, but I would watch it again for the subtext. I think that's what makes it, as I say, it elevates it above the normal kind of run of the crime dramas.
Well, my thanks to Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke for reviewing this week's TV. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Liam Mullen and Niall McMonagall are on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Nasa McLaughlin, and John Creedon is next after the news at 8.